This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Of course, we stream live at the same time at prairiepublic.org, and you can hear our show anytime as a podcast after it's been broadcast at prairiepublic.org. And today we're excited to begin our show with a discussion with Brian Freeman, the novelist whose latest work is Thief River Falls. There's a name that strikes a chord with a lot of us. Brian joins us by phone from the Twin Cities. Thanks for being with us, Brian.
Absolutely. Glad to talk to you.
Well, you were an English major in college. I've done a little research. When did you decide you wanted to become a novelist?
You know, I'm one of those people that being a writer has been my dream as far back as I can remember. In fact, I can remember sitting in sixth grade class working on my first mystery novel. So this goes back a long time.
You describe your books as psychological thrillers. Thief River Falls certainly falls under that genre. Why did you choose that particular form?
You know, I love stories where the drama emerges out of the background and the secrets of the characters, and I love kind of getting inside the heads of the characters. And so mysteries and thrillers really give me an opportunity to do that, to explore different facets of people's personalities, and I put them in some dark and difficult situations and see how the ripple effects of a crime change their lives. And I think it means that the readers can really get emotionally connected to both the heroes in the book and the folks that may do some of the worst things in the book, because you really have a sense of what it is about them as characters that's driving their behavior.
Well, your characters are deeply drawn. Have you studied psychology? Do you work with experts on human behavior when you're developing these ideas?
Well, I was an English major back at Carleton, but my wife was a psychology major, so we it makes for a pretty good 1-2 punch.
All right, so you work together, I take it. You collaborate a bit?
We do, yeah. Marcia is always my first reader on every new manuscript, and she goes through everything in detail from the big picture items of, you know, how the story's told and how the characters unfold, right through all of the individual syntax on the manuscript itself. So every book gets a lot better because of her feedback.
When you're conceiving your lead characters, and it's Lisa Power in Thief River Falls, are you creating a backstory, kind of like an actor might, you know, something that might not be in the book, but is in your mind as you're writing it?
You know, I do. It's kind of a balancing act. In my early books, you know, I've been doing this for 15 years now, and I've got more than 20 books out in the marketplace. And my style has changed a little bit. I think in the first few years, my first few books, I would write just exhaustive character studies before starting in on the manuscript, and I'd have a lot of material written down about every character in the book, and I've kind of dialed that back a bit as I've gotten further on, because the reality is it doesn't matter how much you put down on paper before you start the manuscript. Once you actually start getting words on paper, the characters change and evolve and take on a life of their own, and they really kind of start talking back to you and guiding you. And I was finding that the character studies I would do, no matter how detailed they were, they ended up feeling a little bit sterile, a little bit two-dimensional, and it wasn't really until I started actually writing the manuscript itself that these characters become three-dimensional and start guiding me. And so I decided that, you know, I want to get some basic stuff down about the character, but then I really want them to sort of come alive on the page as I get to them and let them sort of guide that process.
Yeah, I suppose people aren't always logical. They can be quirky.
Well, that's very true.
How would you describe the story of your newest novel to our listeners? It's Thief River Falls is the title, Thief River Falls, Minnesota.
Thief River Falls is it has a couple layers to it. The heroine, Lisa Power, has the same job as I do. She's a thriller writer, and she has written a best-selling novel by the title of
Thief River Falls.
Yes. And so she's gone through a lot of tragedy in her life. She's lost a lot of her family in a very short period of time, and it's thrown her entire life for a loop and kind of turned her world upside down. And so she's moved out of her hometown of Thief River Falls. She's now living about an hour north of there in an even smaller town, Lake Bronson, and she's kind of shut herself off from the world a little bit. And then this young boy shows up at her house in the middle of the night in this distant rural area. And the boy doesn't quite know what's going on. He's been injured. He's lost his memory, but he witnessed something terrible. And Lisa is determined to try to help this child. And she names him Perdue, actually, after the French word lost. And Perdue happens to be the name also that she used for the child in her own book, Thief River Falls. And you can just see that a lot of the echoes of what she was writing about, she ends up pouring into her relationship with this child. And I think it's kind of a question of who needs to rescue whom, because as much as this boy needs help from whatever has happened to him, Lisa's in a situation where I think she needs help just as much.
She quickly becomes a very driven character, and you talk about this book within a book. It actually begins that way. It begins with her book, and there are references to it throughout the story. And because her book was so well known in the story, whenever she's in Thief River Falls or Lake Bronson, everybody recognizes her.
Right. Yeah, that is, and for Lisa, I think it that makes her a little bit uncomfortable. And in that regard, I think she's kind of a classic writer. You know, I mean, we writers tend to be, you know, introverted, introspective personalities, and we're sort of used to spending our days alone staring at that blank screen. So it's a little bit of a shock when all of a sudden you're kind of out dealing with the public, and you know, people recognize you and they're talking to you. And you know, even in Lisa's case, when people are telling her, "Oh, well, we love your book," it makes her a little bit uncomfortable because she doesn't sort of automatically open up to the world around her.
Well, I spent a Sunday reading your book, and I really couldn't put it down. It was a fun story, a lot of interest in that. And I was reading it as I was looking at Google Maps, because you make all these very specific references, so it was entertaining that way. But why did you pick Thief River?
Yeah, well, you know, setting is so important in my mind to the drama of thrillers. I like to give readers kind of a you are there feel. I want you to feel as if you've been dropped down into every scene, and you can hear it and taste it and touch it and smell it and feel it happening all around you. And I think that picking the right location for not only the book as a whole, but every chapter within the book is what really kind of adds to the drama, so that where a scene is taking place enriches what's going on in the minds of the readers. And Thief River Falls, I've literally only been to Thief River Falls once in my life, and it was a long time ago. It was probably 20-plus years ago. I was actually doing a story for a Twin Cities business magazine about one of the businesses up there, DigiKey.
Oh, and, big business, so yes.
Exactly. And I drove up there and explored the town and interviewed a lot of folks up there. And I really enjoyed the drama and remoteness of the terrain itself, and I loved just the name of the town, Thief River Falls. I thought there was so much, you know, great romance and drama in that name. And so I kind of filed that away in the back of my head. And ever since, you know, as my writing career took off and I started publishing novels, I kind of had in the back of my head that I wanted to find just the right story to fit with both the area up there and the name itself, Thief River Falls. And it took me a little while, but finally I found what I thought was just the right story to match up with that terrain, and so I brought that back out, and that's why I chose Thief River Falls.
Brian Freeman is the author of the brand-new thriller, Thief River Falls. It was just published in January. And, Brian, you don't just, you know, explore the place. You really depict the weather with a certain knowledge that only people who live here have, I think.
Yeah, one of the reviewers on one of my Duluth books said that you know, nobody writes weather like Brian Freeman. I consider that a high compliment, I've spent a fair amount of time out in some of those blistering storms just to kind of have my voice recorder in hand and let people know exactly what it feels like. So I always figure when I've got you know, snowbird readers down in Florida and Arizona, if they're getting a little too hot down there, this will give them a little chill when they read one of my books.
The book includes a lot of names of characters in the town. Are any of them based on people you know?
You know, the one character that actually is based on a real person. One of the fun and rewarding things that writers often do is I will team up with nonprofit organizations, and I'll actually have them auction off a character name in an upcoming book. And so the character of Dr. Laurel March in Thief River Falls, that's actually a real person up in northern Minnesota. And she participated in a charity auction in order to get her name in the book. And so that's a real person in there. Of course, I never tell people, you know, are they going to be heroes or villains or victims? So they don't necessarily know what to expect, what they're going to see of themselves when they open up the book.
And we don't know about Laurel until... you know, the book is the book.
We kind of keep that a little uncertain as you're reading the novel.
Including what sort of area of medicine or treatment she's involved in.
That's very true. That's very true.
How about the Pennington County attorney, Dennis Farrell? The heavy for a lot of the book.
It was very funny because shortly after the book came out, I got an email from a woman who was the daughter of the retired Pennington County attorney, and she loved the fact that I kind of made the Pennington County attorney sort of a baddie in the book, and she was very much looking forward to telling her father that he was kind of a villain in this novel.
You are a prolific writer, and you've been on these bestseller lists, so obviously a successful one. One or two novels a year since your debut novel, which was Immoral, that's the title, in 2005. How would you describe your writing process?
You know, I spent so many years in the traditional workforce that I still see my writing world as kind of an 8-to-5 job with just a little bit of a different spin on it. So I'm still, you know, getting up in the morning and taking my coffee into the office each day and working through the day. And I set my deadlines in terms of what I need to have done by the end of a week and a month. So I kind of have know exactly where I am on any given project. And that's what helps me get it done. People say that, you know, don't you deal with writer's block? And it's like, well, you know, writer's block tends to get in the way of my eating. So I don't like to,
okay.
I don't like to think about that.
You're good with self-discipline. How does an idea for a book come to you?
You know, I keep kind of a file of ideas for future books, and it's not necessarily complete concepts of what a plot may look like. It tends to be just little bits and pieces. A character comes to me that might be interesting, a theme that I want to explore, a true crime that I may read about in the newspaper, just kind of a lot of raw material to work with. And so when I'm thinking about a new book, I kind of take out that file and dump everything out, sort of the way you'd pull out your nightstand drawer and dump it on the bed to start organizing it. And I start looking for connections and themes and characters that I want to explore, and I look for how these threads start to come together and make up the jigsaw puzzle of the novel.
Do you outline your stories, or do you discover the end?
I always know where a story is going to end. I like to have kind of the big twists in my head before I start. That's something that's changed a little bit as I've gone along, too. In my early days, I like my character studies. I used to outline the books sort of exhaustively before I started and really, really detailed notes on every chapter. And I've backed away from that over the years. I still do an outline, but it's kind of more of a roadmap where you kind of lay out benchmarks for where you want to be at different points in the book. Because the fact is, no matter how detailed my outline gets, once I actually start writing, within a couple chapters, I sort of end up having to throw it out and rework the outline because, again, when the story and the characters really start taking shape on the page, inevitably it kind of becomes an organic process and takes on a life of its own.
Your protagonist is Lisa Power, novelist in the book Thief River Falls. You mentioned your wife was a psychology major in college. Does she offer some insights about female characters, or is that something you're totally comfortable with?
You know, she absolutely does, but I really enjoy the process of creating and writing female characters. I mean, in some ways, it sounds a little strange, but I'm almost more comfortable creating and writing through the eyes of the female character sometimes than the male characters. I don't know what that means, but I think that's probably true. My preceding book before Thief River Falls was a book called The Deep, Deep Snow, which is available now in ebook and audio as well. And, you know, it was an Audible original, hit the New York Times bestseller list. And that was the first time I'd written a thriller in first person, and it's first person with a female narrator. And so it was a really interesting experience for me to sort of have this woman telling the story, and she sort of had to build a relationship with me and sort of trust me to tell her story. And so it was a fascinating dynamic as a writer to actually go through that process. And I went through much of the same then with Lisa Power in Thief River Falls.
Well, I mentioned, as I did, that I did some research on you. You've got your own website, bfreeman, F-R-E-E-M-A-N, books.com. And, of course, there's a Wikipedia page about you that lists all your published novels. And you have several books that have the same central character, Lieutenant Jonathan Stribe, Cab Bolton, Frost Easton. They're featured, these three are featured in different series of books. Why did you choose to do that?
Well, I've done a lot of series books. I've done a lot of standalones, and I think for me as a writer, it allows me to do some different things. My longest running series is my Jonathan Stride series, which is based over in Duluth, and that's where I started with my first book, Immoral, back in 2005. And I think I've got 10 Jonathan Stride novels available now. In fact, the new book will be coming out in September. And the nice thing about series books is that you've got this base of characters that you're very familiar with, and for a writer, that gives you sort of the, you know, folks that you know and that sort of leap onto the page because you have such experience with them. And I think for readers, they enjoy series books because they could kind of watch the characters grow and evolve as the series go on. And, you know, I write my series books so readers can kind of dive in anywhere, but at the same time, a lot of readers enjoy really kind of watching how the characters change. So Jonathan Stride is a hero. Is very different in a book today than he would have been back in Immoral in 2005 because of all the things that have happened to him along the way. You know, on the other hand, writing standalone novels is a very different kind of experience, and you can kind of create characters knowing that everything that's going to happen to them is going to be between the pages of that book, and I think it gives sort of an intensity to the narrative because you're really putting everything into that one story, and so I think there's a lot of excitement for the reader in that, and for the writer, for me, it's almost harder writing a standalone novel from an emotional standpoint because when I finish off a Jonathan Stride novel or a Frost Easton novel, I know, well, I'm going to meet these characters again. But when I finish up a standalone, it's kind of a sad feeling for me because I know that I'm literally turning the page on characters that have been, you know, very, very close to me for a long period of time, and I'm not necessarily going to meet those characters again. That's kind of the end of their story for me, and there's kind of a grieving process when you get to the end of a standalone manuscript.
Well, as I was looking into your background, I also discovered you've been chosen to be the author of the new Jason Bourne novels, The Creation of the Late Robert Ludlum. I've been reading them since they first came out, and it's, of course, been a starring role for Matt Damon in a lot of action movies. How did that come to be?
That was such an amazing honor. You know, I've been a huge Robert Ludlum fan my whole life. The Bourne Identity, probably my all-time favorite thriller. And in fact, it's the 40th anniversary this year of Ludlum's Bourne Identity novel.
Tells me how old I am. Yeah,
I know. That's a guy. I was thinking exactly the same thing for myself. About 18 months or so ago, I got a call from my agent, and she said that that the Robert Ludlum estate had done a new deal for more Jason Bourne novels with a new publisher, and they were looking for a new writer to take over the series. And would I be interested in throwing my hat in the ring? And of course, you know, again, being such a fan of Ludlum and Bourne, I said absolutely, I'd love to. And then a few months went by, I didn't hear anything, and I just assumed that they'd gone another way. And then I got a call from my agent telling me that Putnam wanted me for the Bourne books, and I put together a plot of how I wanted to kind of reboot the series and wrote some chapters for them, and Putnam loved them and the estate loved them, and we were off to the races, and so literally about 10 minutes, in fact, before I got on the phone with you, I got the call from my editor at Putnam saying that the estate had signed off on the first Bourne book, and they loved it and had no changes whatsoever, which is always a great thing for a writer to hear.
Well, the title, as I understand it, is The Bourne Evolution, which is an interesting choice because, of course, it's evolving into a new series with you.
That's exactly why we chose it. That's right. And that's going to be coming out on July 28th.
And what can you tell us about the story?
Well, you know, what I was trying to do in The Bourne Evolution is really go back to the qualities in the original Ludlum novel that made Jason Bourne such an iconic thriller character. You know, and I think that we've got, you know, so many thriller heroes out there these days that are kind of like, you know, superheroes, and they can do no wrong. And I wanted to go back to what made Jason Bourne special. And I think what really made him such a special character was essentially his sort of fractured mind and his vulnerability, and the fact that he didn't really know who he was, and he had all these skills, and yet he essentially, you know, wasn't sure whether he was a killer or not, and he kind of had to sort of confront his basic questions of identity. I wanted to really go back and really re-explore all of that aspect of who Jason Bourne is. And so this is essentially kind of a reboot of the character, and I'm taking Bourne and dropping him down into the modern setting. And I'm kind of recapturing the essence of his past, and then seeing, okay, how does that, you know, how does that fractured mind and that loss of memory, how does that translate into an all new story? So you don't need to have read any other, you know, Jason Bourne novels to enjoy this one, although I highly recommend The Bourne Identity just because it's one of my all-time favorite books. And similarly, I know there are a lot of you know, movie buffs out there who are going to read this book and be picturing Matt Damon in the role, and that's fine too. So, but I think it really goes back to what Jason Bourne was like as a character when he first kind of came onto the page. I really wanted to bring that back to life.
Well, nevertheless, when I was reading Thief River Falls, I was thinking, boy, this would make a pretty good movie. So are you looking at maybe having a Bourne Evolution movie? Is that what the family's after?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I think the story would adapt itself wonderfully. So we'll see whether we can get Mr. Damon to you know, crack the new one open and see what he thinks.
And Brian, just to give you a sense of how deep my research went, I know that you've written in another genre under a pseudonym by the name of Ali O'Brien. You've written Chick Lit. Tell us about that.
You did do your research. My goodness.
How did that come to be?
You know, quite a few years ago, gosh, it's probably more than a decade ago at this point. My agent at that time was actually based out of London, and her name was Ali Gunn, and she'd always had the idea of writing a novel set inside the sort of wild and woolly British publishing industry, and she was not a writer herself. And so she called me, and we'd already, you know, gone through several books together in my Jonathan Stride novels, and asked if I'd be interested in tackling something completely different. And I thought that sounded like a lot of fun. So I worked up a story concept and worked with her on kind of the lead character, who's sort of inspired a little bit by Ali herself, and wrote the novel. And it was just huge amount of fun to do. It's nothing like my thrillers. It was a hoot to write. I hope it's a lot of fun to read as well. But, you know, we got a great review in People magazine for it, and had a lot of fun with the book. So it was called The Agency, and yeah, the author's name was Ali O'Brien. So it was a combination of Ali's name and my name, and we just had a lot of fun with
What's
it.
What's the elevator speech on that one?
it's about a literary agent in London named Tess Drake who tries to go off on her own and sort of ends up becoming her own worst enemy.
Okay. Well, Brian Freeman, it's been a pleasure to talk with you about your work. And again, the new book, Thief River Falls, is just out. You can get it from Amazon. It's a Kindle download, and it's a bestseller. It's doing quite well. Find out more about Brian at bfreemanbooks.com. He's also on Facebook. And a matter of fact, Google his name because he's all over the Internet. Brian, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, Tom Ezern shares a Plainsfolk essay, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats, and we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Governor Burgum has approved a request for emergency rulemaking from the Secretary of State concerning tribal IDs for Native American voters.
Essentially what it is it codifies what we already has been in policy for a number of years.
Secretary of State Al Jager.
We can program the poll books that we'll be distributing in February to accommodate those situations in the where tribal IDs are used.
Jager says each tribe has its own IDs. He says the requirements are the ID have names, birth date, and residential addresses. The Secretary of State's office will be sending out the new electronic poll books in preparation for the June primary. Jagger says the permanent rules will go through the normal approval procedure in order that permanent rules are in place for the November general election. A bipartisan group of Minnesota lawmakers has announced a proposal to protect voter data collected in the state's presidential primary. The bill would restrict the sharing of party preference data. The parties could only share the data with the national party. That data would be classified as private, and voters could opt out of those lists. DFL Representative Ray Dean of Minneapolis is the House author of the bill. He says voters want action.
I've had many, many constituents and people across the state of Minnesota contacting me and saying that you need to change this. I will not be voting in the presidential primary if my data is available to everybody.
Absentee voting is already underway, but counties have a number of weeks before those ballots are counted and aggregated. The Barnes County Commission has been holding informational meetings about a proposed new jail. In 2019, the Department of Corrections said the existing 112-year-old jail is unsafe for staff and inmates and no longer meets the state-required standards. The estimated cost to build a new jail is $11.9 million, plus an additional $4.4 million for a sheriff's office. Some people believe the issue should be put to a vote of the people. Dean Ross is one of them.
15 years ago, they needed a jail, too, and we've lasted 15 years. Now I know that the state has put some more regulations on and cut the prisoner time that they can be held, and I know all that. But since they put that restrictions on, we've still had a jail, and we probably still can. Elections in November, put it to the vote. Put it to a vote of the people. What's that hurt?
Barnes County Commissioner John Fralick supports building a new jail.
Right now, you got $400,000 that we're going to spend if we don't have the jail. And in my mind, what we're paying to operate this jail is too much money for what we're getting, because we do not have safety for the employees, we do not have safety for the inmates. I'll guarantee you that the bean counters out there in Dumas, they would love to see us not build this jail, because they have their ideas of where they want everything to go.
Fralick says if the jail isn't built, was to stop the state from transferring the judgeship to Jamestown. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A lot has been written about North Dakota and the Nonpartisan League, and Prairie Public's television service created a three-part documentary about the NPL. But historian Tom Ezrin says the political movement's significance benefits from analysis in a new book, and that's the subject of his Plainsfolk essay titled Four for the League.
At heart, the story of the Nonpartisan League is about leadership, writes Terry L. Shoptaw, author of Sons of the Wild Jackass, the Nonpartisan League in North Dakota. His focus on the NPL elite is old-fashioned political history, but it makes significant contributions to our understanding of our political heritage on the Northern Plains. The author, archivist emeritus of Minnesota State University Moorhead, is an established regional historian. Of his many works, I would point particularly to his History of the Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers, Roots of Success, and to his profile of Hermann Stern, rescuer of persecuted Jews from Nazi Germany. You have been kind enough to assist me. Now he is roasting the biggest chestnut in North Dakota history, the Nonpartisan League, which effort calls for some appraisal. The old standard work on the subject dates from 1955, Political Prairie Fire by Robert Moreland. Moreland's work is not just dated, it is flawed in idiosyncratic ways. Excessive reliance on the NPL's own literature and obsessive focus on the charismatic Arthur C. Townley. A more sophisticated treatment is the 2015 work, Insurgent Democracy, by Michael Lansing. Lansing takes a more critical view, but also strives to recapture the NPL for the progressive tradition, considering it as an episode of movement culture. Now, if I were to tackle the subject of the NPL, I would go after its popular base, try to understand what circumstances and strategies moved and stirred the farmers of North Dakota, most of them of recent immigrant stock, to join up. I believe Hans Nielsen Hauge and evangelical Lutheranism had a lot to do with this. But the subject today is not what I would say about the NPL, but what Choptaw says. Four men, he argues, were the movers and shakers. Townley, the master of stump oratory who is incapable of managing a farm, let alone a movement. William Lemke, the born organizer, the detail guy, tireless, perhaps manipulative, but a financial wreck. William Langer, courageous and devious, by turns noble and disgraceful. And Lynn J. Frazier, the least scrutable of the four, but probably the most sensible. These four potential saviors were the ones who challenged North Dakota's politics, but their errors and flaws, Choptaw concludes, broke the movement into fragments. So, what do we profit from a new history of the League? Choptaw has no axe to grind, but simply examines actions and evidence and makes considered statements, some of them rather critical of the NPL. Of Townley, at the height of his powers, he asks, was the attention becoming so enjoyable that it might affect his judgment? Well, yes. Choptaw deems the anti-capitalist rhetoric of the NPL to have been excessive because it provoked rancorous exchanges with the opposition, the Independent Voters Association, and the very rancor of political discourse proved debilitating to a movement that rested on grassroots support from decent farm folk. The author also brings new research to the table, not only newspapers accessed via digital technology, but also old-fashioned manuscript research, particularly in collections at the University of North Dakota. Choptaw's treatment of the Minnie-Nielsen affair, which caused Bill Langer to split with party leadership, and particularly his exploration of the reports of private detectives that Langer sicked on his rivals, these are rich new narratives. Given the consequence of the Nonpartisan League in regional history, the region's scholarly press, North Dakota State University Press, needed to have a title on the subject. How fortunate that Dr. Choptaw came forth with such a judicious work to fill the bill.
That's Tom Ezard. Coming up, Sue Belcom and Main Street Eats.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me from our Bismarck studio is Sue Belcom from Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
She joins Main Street once a week to talk about food for Main Street Eats, and you know that expression, you are what you eat. Well, what we are and what we eat can have profound impacts on the quality of our life, especially when it comes to the impact on the gut. So, Sue, this microbiome thing, the collection of bacteria that's in the gut that allows the gut to do all the important work that it does, our diets can really impact this.
Well, yeah, and I'm doing a little research into this because I am surrounded by people that have gut issues, and it manifests itself in many different ways, but actually the statistics are staggering. They said that irritable bowel syndromes or these types of gut health issues have increased by 45% since 1999. Now, there's got to be a reason, don't you think? That's 3 million people that have been diagnosed, which means that there are people out there that probably have never been diagnosed and are just living with this complication here.
Right, because there's a lot of things people don't realize might be a symptom of an unhealthy gut, like even just like joint pain.
Absolutely, any kind of inflammation in your body anywhere. And so I picked up this magazine at the doctor's office because somebody in my family is having these kinds of issues. And it was called the Time Health Magazine, and it was just jam-packed full of really interesting information. And since this is the beginning of the year and people are still looking into things they can do to be healthy, I thought just a little bit of conversation about what's going on in your tummy. Like, for one thing, there's nerve endings and there's things going on in there that are almost equivalent to the activity in your brain. Like, your brain and your stomach talk to each other.
They do. Yeah, well, they call the gut the second brain.
Right. And so think about, you know, what you're doing when you're stressed out. You know,
eating.
That is definitely something that you'll feel the effect in your gut, whether it's simply butterflies or whether you're going to be late for every meeting you ever go to because you're in the bathroom, because you're stressed out about something.
Yeah.
So they think that stress plays a big part in this, but also your diet. You know, Americans have really sad diet of heavily processed foods, lots of additives in our food, low fiber foods, and lots of sugar. And, you know, you can't get away from it. Ever since I started working outside of the house, you know, you're interacting with people. If you're in an office, we had this conversation over Christmas. Everybody that came to my house brought a plate of cookies. And I'm just looking around thinking, what am I going to do with these people? We can't possibly, the two of us, eat all these cookies.
Right.
And they're like, take them to work. They'll eat anything at work. And I'm like, yeah, that is the truth. When it's there,
yeah,
it's so easy to stick it in your mouth.
Right. And I do that. And then
when
I really stop and think about, okay, well, a cookie from this department and a cookie from that department and two more from this one.
And right. And so I'm always weighing the odds. I'm like, is that cookie really good enough to warrant all those calories? And most of the time the answer would be no. Although my chocolate cake with chocolate ganache filling, that's an exception to every rule.
Well, chocolate's always amazing.
Yum!
So what is happening, though? Like, why would sugar impact that that balance of the microbiome?
Boy, I don't know, but I heard that it was addicting as heroin. Sugar is just simply one of those empty calories. You know, there's nothing that it would feed the good microbiome in your gut. It is just not a good thing. And it's hidden in everything we eat. That and sodium, which is bad for your blood pressure if you have high blood pressure. People need to read labels. I mean, that is like so important. I love to read, and I don't know if reading labels is part of that, but I never buy anything without looking at the labels.
Yeah.
And you know that there
stores
are yogurts.
Stress me out.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
I really like online shopping, but don't tell everybody that. I like to shop online, then I go to the store and pick it up. That's my favorite thing to do. Or send my husband. That's even better. But, you know, there are yogurts out there that have more sugar in them than a Snicker bar. And a Snicker bar at least has peanuts in it, so it has protein. And so sometimes when you're weighing out what you're going to eat, go for the Snickers bar. It's probably healthier for you.
There's a lot of food that masquerades as health food.
Totally. So read the labels. And then go outside for lunch.
Okay, yeah, because you said lack of sunlight impacts
oh my
your
gosh.
Gut health?
Think about the way our society has changed. You know, over the years, people are moving indoors. There are people that I know that absolutely hate to mow their lawn because they do not like to be outside. And they say that the people who live at the latitudes that are in the sunshine more often than not actually have less instances of any IBD-related diseases than the people who don't get out in the sun. So, you know, as we move away from the agrarian lifestyle, we're indoors, we're sitting in front of computers. There's something about the sun's ultraviolet rays that trigger a release of hormones that suppresses aspects of the immune function, and then that plays a role in keeping the inflammation down, and it also helps with any autoimmune disorders. So you need the vitamin D too. The sun is out there as a blessing for all of us. Just go out and enjoy it. And I'm telling you, when it's 20 below, the sun coming up is magnificent. It's the best part of winter is the sunshine when it's so stinking cold.
Well, you said this is moving away from an agrarian lifestyle, so that's impacting our levels of sunlight and how much we're sitting, but also just the actual surroundings. And you sent on this cheat sheet that overly sterile surroundings impact gut health.
Yep, I've never understood how paranoid some people have become about germs. Mm. Because if you could see all the germs on your body, you'd look like Pigpen from the Charlie Brown cartoon strip.
I already look like that.
I do too. And my hair proves it.
This is why I'm on radio.
Right. You're right. I don't want people to actually see what that looks like. But they say, yay for cow poop, man. Research has found that people who grew up in rural locales and spend time around farm animals actually have lower rates of these diseases than people who grow up in the cities or the suburbs. You need to be exposed to germs in order to build up an immunity to germs. Plus, if you're living like out where I live, we don't have traffic all the time. So we get less vehicle air pollution, which they think is another thing that's probably irritating people's guts and sensitivities.
Sue, you've given us a lot to think about. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We live in a world with such complicated corporations and organizations that it's hard to even start talking about making them ethical. How can we expect them to be moral? How can we be good when we have so little control? Join me and my guest Lisa Herzog as we create order out of bureaucracy and ask, does it make sense to blame the system? On the Next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
That's the question we ask every Thursday here on Main Street. And Christine McClellan from the fourth floor is with me today. She handles some community outreach for Prairie Public. And today she's looking at our calendar of stuff to do.
Yes, here's what's going on. So Capitol Shakespeare is putting on a production of The Glass Menagerie. This is Friday through Sunday, February 7th through 9th, at the North Dakota State Heritage Center in Bismarck. The Glass Menagerie is a play written by Tennessee Williams, and it's set in Depression-era St. Louis, while each family member struggles to pursue their own happiness despite their means. So this is a free production to go and see. Friday and Saturday, it's at 7 p.m., and Sunday, it's at 2 p.m.
You know, I've seen this play several times. It was also a famous movie. Tennessee Williams wrote a classic American play here. If you get a chance to see it, it's a great piece of theater. A full snow moon candlelight hike in Garrison is February the 8th at Fort Stevenson State Park. You can cross-country ski, snowshoe, or hike. The park staff will use candle luminaries to light the trail, so that'll be fun. You'll just meet at the visitor center at 6 p.m. Again, that's February the 8th. That would be Saturday. The trail is approximately 1 mile in length. Ski and snowshoe rentals are available on a first-come, first-served basis, and you can reserve that equipment by calling ahead at the park office. And again, Saturday at 6 o'clock is when everything starts. It costs from $7 to $22, and it is a kid-friendly event.
The Attica Strings of the Fargo-Moorhead Area Youth Symphonies are presenting a concert full of color. This is this Sunday, February 9th, at the First Presbyterian Church in Fargo. You can join their newest ensemble as they present a concert inspired by all the colors of the rainbow. So again, this is Sunday, February 9th. It starts at 7, ends around 9, and tickets range from $5 to $10.
Murder Under the Big Top in Dickinson at the Grand Dakota Hotel. It opens this evening, runs through Saturday. It's a murder mystery play. There will be prizes for the best dressed each night. It includes a social dinner and, of course, the play. The tickets are $45 to $50, and it runs Thursday through Saturday at 6 o'clock. That's Murder Under the Big Top at the Grand Dakota Hotel in Dickinson.
The Valley City Bluegrass Jam Session is going to be at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City on Saturday, February 8th. This is an acoustic-only jam, and it's open to all age levels of bluegrass musicians. It's sponsored by the Bluegrass Association of North Dakota and the Barnes County Museum. So this is free to attend. Bring your banjos on Saturday, 1 to 5 p.m. at the Barnes County Museum.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra presents Symphonic Stories, Steal Away Home is the title. It's in Bismarck, of course, at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium, and it's Saturday evening. Dr. Rebecca Raber, commentator and director, Dr. Jeff Stone and Teresa Koulis, soloist, and the Prairie Jubilee Chorus will be among those featured. Dr. Raber leads the spiritual as code in the Underground Railroad. That's a symphonic portrait and a look at the use of music by slaves in their journeys to freedom. The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra leads us home with Dvorak's famous New World Symphony. So this is Saturday. It begins at 7:30 in the evening. Again, the Belle Mayhus Auditorium. Tickets are $20 to $40.
The Giving Hearts Day Winter Market is going to be at the Moorhead Center Mall on Saturday, February 8th. Those who are missing weekends at the Farmers Market at the Red River Market in Fargo will get a chance to stock up on their favorite goods from local vendors at the Giving Hearts Day Winter Market. Visitors can shop for locally made food products, see cooking skills demonstration, listen to live music, all while in the warmth and comfort of the great indoors. So this is Saturday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., and it's free to attend.
And Giving Hearts Day is something that Prairie Public benefits from as well, isn't it?
Yes, so it's February 13th. You can schedule a donation today.
I've been seeing the signs everywhere, and you can remind our listeners that this is another way to help what they're listening to.
Yep.
The Griffin String Quartet is in Grand Forks, February 9th. That's Sunday at the Hughes Fine Arts Center. The Griffin String Quartet is the resident string quartet of Midsummer's Music in Door County, Wisconsin. They're presenting string quartets by Haydn and Brahms Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And the price is right. It's free. So the Griffin String Quartet, Sunday afternoon at 2 at the Hughes Fine Arts Center in Grand Forks.
Minot Symphony Orchestra is hosting a concert, The Remarkable Farkle McBride. This is going to be at Minot State University, the Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. This is Saturday, February 8th. So travel with The Remarkable Farkle McBride in his quest for the perfect musical instrument to play. They will feature Copland's 1938 Outdoor Overture, which was originally billed as American Music for American Youth. There's also going to be an instrument petting zoo, so bring your kids and try out different instruments, see what they like. So this is Saturday, February 8th. There's a pre-concert talk that begins at 2 p.m., and the concert starts at 3 p.m., and tickets range from $10 to $30.
Well, we've reached that point where it's time for you to give your pick of the week, and I know this is another one that we're involved with.
Yes, I like picking the ones that we're involved with. So we will be at the MSUM Planetarium in Moorhead this Saturday, February 8th, for the Stars of PBS. This is our sixth year doing this event. We partner with MSUM to host this planetarium show. It's a show called Big Bird's Adventure, One World, One Sky, and it's a show that's narrated by Big Bird, and there's other Sesame Street characters there, too. And along with the planetarium show, we have a bunch of science demonstrations. There's activities, drawings for prizes, and we have a PBS Kids character there. We're having Super Y, so you can come and meet Super Y. This is all free. It's 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The show times, they start every 45 minutes, starting at 10 a.m., and tickets are first come, first serve. But, you know, while you're waiting for your show, you can go around and do all the activities.
MSU Moorhead has had a planetarium for decades. It was not so long ago really upgraded, so it's a brand new experience if you haven't done it in a while. And it's a lot of fun for the family.
Yes.
So take it in Saturday. The Roommate is my pick. It's in Moorhead. It opens tonight, runs until the end of the month, and February has 29 days this year, 2020. It's at Theater B, which is in near North Moorhead. The story of The Roommate is two middle-aged women, one leaving New York to start over, one rattling around in her big Iowa home, become roommates. And this has surprising twists, unexpected discoveries, and insightful humor. It's a 21st century odd couple that will probably leave the audience guessing. At least that's what the blurb says. It stars a couple of really good performers, Pam Strait and Carrie Winterstein. Again, Thursdays through Saturday at 7:30, Sunday matinees February 16th and 23rd at 2 o'clock. Tickets for adults are $25, students $12. That's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 6th. Every part of the country has its own types of natural disasters. In the south, they get hurricanes. In the west, earthquakes. And here in the north, we get blizzards that have miles of flat plains to blow through. One memorable storm is the blizzard of 1984, which swept across the Great Plains with 60-mile-per-hour winds. It hit Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, and, of course, North Dakota. The cold air even went as far south as Texas. A New York Times article from this date that year described the situation. In one 50-mile stretch, the storm had stranded about 800 motorists along Interstate 90. A Minnesota State Patrol spokesperson said, "I'd say it's the worst storm so far this year due to the fact that it came upon us so fast. This is why many motorists were stranded. They were caught off guard." The temperature dropped to 16 degrees below zero, and while the National Guard worked tirelessly to rescue people, 23 still died. Four of those deaths happened on 19th Avenue North in Fargo, where they became stranded in a snow-clogged underpass. Running the car to keep warm, they succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning as the car's exhaust system became blocked by the snow. Their deaths have served as a long-lasting lesson. Ben Dow, the current Fargo Public Works Director, said in a recent article that the city has completely changed its protocol. Now they don't hesitate to close roads, and they will have crews periodically check those roads. Mark Williams, manager of Public Works Services, also said they'll make sure to run snow plows through roads before they close them to ensure there's no one already stranded. To close roads, the city has installed snow gates at several vulnerable locations. The city is also using snow screens to lessen the amount of snow reaching those roadways. Throughout North Dakota, such safety measures have made our blizzards much less deadly. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Fears about the coronavirus are keeping Chinese tourists at home and have left the global tourism industry in limbo.
We are monitoring the situation very carefully and very closely, but it's too soon for us to make an assumption on exactly how this is going to affect business in the long term.
The financial impact of the coronavirus on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Just a minute or so left in Main Street to remind you that the Short and Sweet on-air membership drive ended last Saturday, but we've extended it until Friday for those of you who want to just make that phone call. That's 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org and get that one-pound box of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry sent to whoever you want it to, including yourself. At any rate, you'd be supporting what you're listening to right now, and we definitely appreciate that and thank those who have. Friday on Main Street, Jack Russell Weinstein will preview this Sunday's episode of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. His topic is Can Financial Markets Be Moral? News Director Dave Thompson will join us for our weekly discussion of topics in the news. And Madeline will review Harriet and make some Oscar predictions. The Academy Awards ceremony is Sunday night. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.